December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Today I have the pleasure of introducing Steve Snyder, who's written a book called Shot Down. It's a harrowing story of his father's adventure. I don't want to say misadventure, his adventure in flying over the skies of Europe during World War II. And so introducing Steve Snyder. Steve, welcome aboard.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Nice to be here.
Pleasure, sir. So I'd love to hear about you. I'd love to hear about your, I read it in your book, a lot of your background with regards to first becoming aware of the story of your father, him not talking about it much, and eventually you learning through some of his peers or some of the folks who also flew about about you picking up more and more information, doing the visits, becoming more interested in it, especially after retirement. So can you tell me a little bit about that experience and what really made you interested in learning more about your father's experience?
Okay, well, I was always interested in World War II. I was born in 1947, so
gotcha.
Just a couple of years
baby boomer.
After the war ended, definitely.
Right.
And so I was always interested in World War II. I read a lot of books about it. And growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II experiences.
Gotcha. Okay.
I knew he was a B-17 bomber pilot. Right. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. He flew bombing missions over Europe. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually got back to England. But like you mentioned, it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and learn more details. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action. Okay. About his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting.
I didn't make the connection, so that was your father's diary then. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then the other item were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother while he was stationed in England before he got shot down. And reading those is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and I just went on a quest to find everything that I could find out about the World War II and the air war and about my dad's experiences. And 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it and be familiar with it. So I decided to write a book.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, we lose so much of that. We lose so much of the history and everyone's got a story. Your father's obviously got a fascinating one that not only impacted him, but you, but also everyone pretty much everyone in the free world, you know, it impacted. So, you know, I'm glad you were able to capture it. And you captured so much detail with regards to the entire, not just his activities, but, you know, understanding the equipment itself, the everything that anyone would want to know about that theater and about specifically the Air Force. Was he Air Force or AV? Or he transferred to Air Force from
yes.
the Army.
Yeah. Initially, he went into the Army as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940. My dad went into the Army in the spring of 41, and he was actually in the infantry for a year.
Okay.
And then he transferred, or volunteered, I should say, for the Air Force.
Right.
And like you say, the book does have a tremendous amount of detail. It's really kind of two books in one. One's the story of my dad and his crew, which is all based on firsthand testimony by the people who were involved in the events that took place.
Okay.
Then what I added was kind of history,
okay.
you know, historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it into context,
right.
give it background.
Yeah. Were you in the military yourself?
I was in the California Army National Guard for 6 years during the Vietnam years, from 70 to 76.
Okay.
And fortunately for me, my unit wasn't called up to go over to Vietnam.
Fortunately, yeah. I have a friend of mine who he did hard time in Hawaii during the entire Vietnam War, you know, and that's not a bad hard time to do if you have
to do time. No, that's good duty there.
Yeah, exactly. So what's fascinating to me, and I'd like for you, if you don't mind, to give a little bit more of the higher level view of the activities that took place with regards to your father getting shot down and how he basically survived through that entire 6 month period of time to be able to slowly work its way out, including the support network that was there to pick him up, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, his plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane, the B-17 Susan Ruth, they were on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany.
Okay.
And they dropped their bomb successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire called flak, and they couldn't get him back up. And as a result, they
tremendous drag.
Kind of lost airspeed, started lagging behind the bomber formation that was heading back to England to their bases. Right. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, like lions or wolves, came in for the kill. Right. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew, a B-17 had a 10-man crew, four officers and six enlisted men. Two of the crew were killed in the plane when it was attacked. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. After my dad bailed out, he came down in the little village of Mackinac, Belgium, was right at the French border. And he landed into some trees and his parachute got hung up and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him.
Okay.
This occurred in the early afternoon, and they told my dad to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during the daylight with German patrols combing the area.
Right.
So that night they came back and got my dad and took him to the Durvan farmhouse, and he stayed there one night. Because again, they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that for those German patrols in the area. And the Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to another location. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. He might stay one night at a house, he might spend 6 weeks. It all depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there.
Because they were still actively looking for him since they did not find a body. Well, they didn't know he was on the plane, so it's not like they were looking specifically for him.
Well, no. Belgium was occupied by the Nazis at that time.
Right.
But they constantly did these random searches of houses all the time. So you always had to be on guard. And there's several instances in the book where where my dad was almost discovered.
Okay.
The Belgian people who hid my dad, or any downed airmen for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but those of their family and friends, because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. My dad really owed them a great deal. He said that they let him sleep in their bed. They slept on the floor. They would give him the majority of the food, and you know, everything was rationed back then. So, you know, there was a shortage of food. Unbelievably brave people.
Yeah.
But it was also very stressful for my dad as well. After all, you know, his plane's attacked, it's on fire, he has to bail out, he comes down into a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the military.
And how far away they spread out?
Well, he was totally separated from other members of the crew. He never knew what happened to any of them until he got back to England.
Okay.
And then he's being helped by these Belgian people who, you know, they couldn't speak the same language. They're complete strangers. And any one of them could have been a collaborator and turned them over to the Gestapo. So several months after being hidden at these various places, he got tired of hiding. And he decided to join the French resistance. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. He became very frustrated with it. So he decided to get back into the fight. Word came that the Allies had landed in Normandy on June 6th, D-Day of 1944. And he felt it was his duty to get back and fight the Germans. Unlike most airmen, he had that year's experience in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he joined a unit of the French resistance. They were nicknamed the Mackie, and they were made up of independent small guerrilla groups located all across France. And their job was to harass the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys. And there are several instances described in the book of encounters that they had with the German. And fighting with them for a while, finally on September 2nd of 1944, okay. Word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Treslong, France. Okay. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day and liberated that
How
area.
How far was this away from the war then, or towards the end of the war?
Well, it was September of 44, and the war ended 75 years ago today. Today is VE Day, Victory in Europe.
Wow.
And I actually have my Victory in Europe t-shirt on here.
I like that too. Yeah, that's great. Wow.
So he walked into the town square and went up to an army major, you know, identified himself. They interrogated to make sure he was who he said he was. And he caught a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. And then from Paris, he got on a transport and got back to England, where he sent a telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I can, you know, I didn't even think about it from the standpoint of your grandmother or his wife.
Yeah, my mother.
Your mother, yeah. That's, you know, Think Different Nation is about, what I like to look at is, I believe we all are on an evolutionary journey of man. And I believe that we all have instincts. You know, it's 30 plus instincts, including fear, curiosity, organization, leadership. And the fear is that strong one. You know, as we go through COVID-19 today, especially several weeks ago in New York, where tensions were high, we didn't know how you could get infected. And just the deaths we saw in some of the major cities, fear was there. And I can't imagine the fear that your father went through, that the Belgian citizens went through in holding him, those conversations that took place between the family members to decide whether in fact they're going to take on that risk that they didn't have to take on, as well as just your mother and grandmother being at home and enduring this chemical reaction known as fear within their bodies. You were not able to talk to your father about the experience, though, were you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. My dad wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91.
Okay.
And like as you mentioned earlier, you know, growing up, he didn't talk about the, like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk about the war. But in 1989, a memorial was erected in the little village of Mackinaws to my dad and his crew.
Okay.
And my father and the three other crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication of that memorial. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war.
Wow.
He visited those homes that he was hidden in.
Yeah.
And that brought it all back, and he started talking about it after that. And then 5 years later, in 1994, my wife and I accompanied my parents to the 50th anniversary celebrations of the Belgian liberation, of my dad's plane being shot down.
Okay.
And that's when it became personal for me, because I walked in my dad's shoes and saw these places where he was hidden, been in those houses, and that's when it became personal for me.
Yeah, it's when I think back on it, and again, you know, thinking about the doctors and the nurses in New York and the different cities, how do you go in and do something? You know, in your father's situation, there wasn't a lot of TV. He didn't see war on TV. He heard about, of course, I'm sure, the World War I experience, but he didn't see the graphic details that we see of war when we watch movies like Saving Private Ryan and so forth. So therefore, I would imagine there was a great deal of excitement about going to fight, not really understanding what fighting truly entailed. Is that what your father experienced?
Absolutely. You raise a very good point there, Ty. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, back then in the 40s, the country, the United States, was a totally different country. You know, today most people live in cities. You know, back then it was very rural. Most people lived out in the country. It was very provincial. A lot of these young guys, you know, they had never even been out of their home, their county. And all of a sudden they're halfway across the world. And these guys were only in their late teens, either right out of high school or early 20s, you know, never been away from their family, never been away from their mother. And as you mentioned back then, I mean, there was no television, there was no social media, there was no internet. You only got your news through a magazine or a newspaper.
Right.
And so they were, most people were really, you know, didn't know that much about what was going on in the world.
Right.
They just read about it. So my dad said it was, when he went, you know, in and then was in England, it was very exciting. It was the defining moment of these guys' lives. I mean, they've never experienced anything like that.
It's like life on steroids times 10. Yeah, I can imagine.
I mean, they're away from home for the first time. They had total freedom. They could drink, they could smoke, they could chase women. You know, it was a whole new experience for them. Here they were mixed in with all these other guys from other parts of the country, different religions, different nationalities. So it was a big deal for those guys.
Yeah, it was, but then you go into the actual battle and the first shot is fired and you see your first friend, what happens, and then it becomes real.
Right.
Yeah.
And the 8th Air Force, was amazing. There were 26,000 men that were killed in the 8th Air Force fighting the air war over Europe. And that's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific.
Wow.
Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either German fighters or anti-aircraft fire. Mm-hmm. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment that there was. They'd go on these missions, guys would be killed, they'd come back to their quarters, you know, beds would be empty from guys that died, and then they just, you know, they had to keep going back and keep going back up, never knowing if that mission might be their last. So, they grew up real quick.
Yeah, and I don't know if I could do that, you know, and just being honest, call it cowardice or call it whatever, you know, I know I have my own stress, I know I have my own fears, I know a lot of my fears and that which I deal with, that which creates fear for me. Other folks would say I couldn't do that, I could go off the battle, but I couldn't go and deal with the stress that you're dealing with on a daily basis. So we all have the drivers that really, really move us. But that particular one, you know, of physical harm is something that I'd like to hope that I have the courage to do what I needed to do in the time where you were called. But, you know, when those guys, when they're on the boat, the plane, you didn't have an out. You know, you're already there. And so therefore, it's not like you can actually turn around and say, I'm not going to do this anymore. You're fully committed. You're like the pig versus the chicken for breakfast.
Absolutely. You know, and another thing that amazed me about my father is that, mm-hmm. you know, he was being hidden and he could have stayed hidden and just waited for the U.S. armies to come up to liberate the area. But
wasn't in him.
To have the bravery and the courage to then decide to join the French resistance and fight against the Germans, because he could have died, Pacquiao in fighting the Germans, or if the Germans had captured him while he was with the French,
nice,
he would have been shot on the spot as a terrorist. So I certainly don't know how many people would have done that. I doubt if I would have.
Yeah. You know, but it's, I guess it's just one step further. If you're willing to go and face death in a plane, then you've already faced it. You know, you've already survived that. You've already dealt with the chemical reaction, and therefore you know how to control it. And so I guess it makes it a lot easier to continue forward because you already know the feelings that your body's going to have and you know how to control it. But was anyone else in your family ever in war prior to that? Possibly World War One? Was there a history?
None of the family was in World War One. I have ancestors that were back in war, but I, you know, that's so long ago, I never knew them.
Okay.
My grandfather, he wasn't the right age to go and to serve in World War One.
Okay.
So just my dad in World War Two.
Right.
Another big decision he had to do that, though, he was married. You know, most of the guys weren't married. And he had two children, because his plane was named after my oldest sister, uh-huh. Susan Ruth. And then my other sister, Nancy, was born while he was missing in action. Now, my mother was pregnant when my dad went overseas. So that was a decision, you know, that, well, I have a family back home.
Yeah.
But he still risked his life to defend his country and to fight for freedom.
Yeah. How was his, this is his first time, I would imagine, going overseas as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
what was his perception like of the entire experience? You know, I would imagine it was like you had mentioned before, a transformational, and that experience alone can catapult you further in your life when you return. Did you see anything that he was able to leverage after that experience when he came back and actually entered back into society as a, I guess, what is it called? You know, as a regular person.
Yeah, I think it, not only my dad, but that whole generation, you know, who went to war, they matured very quickly. And when they came back, they're called the greatest generation. I certainly think they are for what the sacrifice that they made. And then, but they never considered themselves heroes or anything special. When you talk to World War II veterans, they'll tell you that, well, you know, everyone participated. We had a job to do. I just went over there and did my little part, my little job. Then I came back to the U.S. and got on with my life and tried to earn a living and raise a family. But I think a lot of those guys, and certainly my dad, you know, it toughened him up. My sisters and I always compared my dad to John Wayne. You know, he was a big guy. He was 6'3". Rugged guy, no nonsense guy, disciplinarian, but a loving father. But and they believed in hard work and in caring for their families. They were a special men.
Yeah, it's there's been such a transformation that's taken place over the last X number of years. You know, like you had mentioned, who was the gentleman that wrote the book? The reporter, rather. Was it Brokaw or that wrote, coined the phrase, the greatest generation?
Yeah, that was Tom Brokaw.
Tom Brokaw. Okay, yeah. You know, it's, we're changing as a nation and as a people, for better, for worse. I think there's always a positive whenever a negative appears. And so it's hard to see what's going to happen next. How would your father compared to what's happening today with regards to the servicemen, and you know, since they have had so many experiences with, again, you know, the social media, the seeing the broader picture of the world, you probably haven't had an opportunity to speak to servicemen of this era, I would imagine.
Oh, I've spoken to some. They have a lot of the same traits. You know, our you know, back then, you know, all those guys were citizen soldiers. They were just citizens. And all of a sudden, boom, you become a soldier. Unlike today that, you know, soldiers go in, they train, they're prepared to go to battle.
Right.
So it's a different situation, but still all the men and women who serve in the military today, you know, make a big commitment out of their lives to serve and protect.
Yeah. Now, so what's next for you? And how do you keep the message, or how do you keep his legacy alive with regards to the contribution that he made?
Well, what I do, and the book's just not about my dad. The book goes into detail about what happened to each member of his group. Right. Something different happened to each guy. Right. And also a great deal about those courageous Belgian people that risked their lives to help them. So really, my message is not just about my dad or his crew, but the entire 8th Air Force and, you know, anyone really who served in World War II. Until this year, every year I travel all around the United States, going to air shows, signing copies of my book. I do a lot of public speaking, making PowerPoint presentations, to all sorts of different organizations. And it's really my mission to remember, honor, and educate, to remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and to educate the public about it, especially younger generations.
Yeah.
Because, you know, World War II ended, or the war in Europe ended 75 years ago today. And that's a long time ago, and it's fading in people's memories, especially the younger generations. And we can't let that happen.
How do you keep it from happening, though?
Well, you just try to get the message out and educate and talk to people so that they realize that the freedoms that we enjoy today were fought for and people died for. It's you know, we've never had a war on our soil. We've never had a catastrophic, you know, confrontation like World War II. So, you know, we've always, you know, we're kind of, well, I don't know, it's the best word for it, kind of fat and happy and in a sense ignorant here about, you know, what can happen. That's why when you go to Europe and visit these occupied countries, I mean, they really have an appreciation because they went through Nazi occupation, Nazi oppression, and they lost their freedoms, and they really value them. A lot of people, you know, in the U.S. today just take it for granted because it's always been there.
Yeah, I think about, I did grad school in France, and one of my roommates was a French woman, and I had an opportunity to meet her father. And her father, in French, told me the experience of meeting his first serviceman when he was 9 years old or eight or something like that, and being given a pack of cigarettes. And that was a fond experience that he had, meeting the first serviceman to come into town. You know, we do have such a short memory. We haven't experienced that. Even with, for example, the virus, it would have been quite a different experience if, in fact, it produced blood, such as Ebola. It would have been mind-numbing for everyone to see that impact, and therefore things would have changed as compared to just having something similar to the flu, whereby you can't really see the devastating consequences as clearly as you can an Ebola victim. So, you know, like you said, the experience of having been to war in Europe, for example, and the fact that they do remember it, and the next generation remembers, and at least they have the monuments of the war, but we don't have that, which means outside of going to D.C. to see the Vietnam Memorial, the Korean War, and so forth, you're really not going to pick up on that, capture that sensitivity to the destruction that is caused when war occurs.
Yes, you know, cities were just leveled, and I've been to Belgium 6 times, and the Belgian people do a great job of continually educating the younger generations about the importance of remembering what took place. You mentioned that the French gentleman that was 9 years old. I probably would not have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen who were young boys during the war. Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Vallot, they saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis against their families and friends. Later on in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information that's in the book that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a huge debt.
You know, I have a picture of, I did some work in Poland, as a matter of fact, Warsaw. And I have a picture of myself in the main square in Warsaw. My wife traveled over, my ex-wife rather, and my daughter, and she's standing there in this picture, right in the big square. And I just happened to find a picture online at the exact same angle where she had been standing. And now you can see the building was rebuilt, but you can see how the destruction had literally obliterated the area where she was standing. And so just to be able to see the juxtaposition, ironically, of the two pictures of now and then, what was, what is now, I can't imagine any more of a harrowing experience. You know, I can't imagine going through that. You survive if you're able to survive, but just the thought of having to survive it is something that many people would say, nah, just kill me today.
Yeah, 60 million people died during World War II, and the majority of the people who died were civilians. Yeah, and Poland, as you mentioned, was just completely devastated. And even after the war, you know, homes are destroyed. All these millions of people are displaced and left homeless. They have no home. There's, you know, no food. You know, they're starving. So what those people went through in the occupied countries in Western Europe, or you know, in China or Korea, as Americans, we just can't imagine.
Comprehend it. No. It's impossible to conceive of that which occurred. And we were so isolated, to your point, that we wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a great story, and thank you for having written it. What's your next step? Outside of doing the tours, the discussions, and are you planning on writing anything else?
Well, not right now. I did make a little documentary. It's a little 13-minute documentary short that I've entered into quite a few film festivals. Okay. So far, it's been accepted by 11 in the 5 that have occurred, won awards in 4 of the 5.
Okay.
So that's something I'm involved in too, and then. Just, I spend hours every day on the internet and social media, you know, promoting the book and things. Really, it's really like I have a full-time job again.
Yeah. And that's good.
Yeah, it's changed my life, and it's a passion of mine. I love doing it. I love talking about it. And just, you know, as I mentioned, to try to educate other people and other generations about what took place.
Right.
It's a fascinating subject to begin with.
Yeah, it is.
And then what happened to my dad and the other members of his crew was just such a unique story.
Yeah.
And then the topper during my research is finding the German Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane and interviewing him for the book.
Right.
Becoming friends with him.
Did he recall that experience?
Well, actually, the gunners on my dad's plane shot him down at the same time. They shot him.
Okay. Turnabout is fair play.
And he bailed out, and he came down. Belgium was occupied by the Germans, so they picked him up and sent him back to his base. Fortunately for him, he lived through the war. He's the only person in the shot down story who's still living. He's 96 years old. He lives in Munich, Germany. And fortunately for me, became a translator after the war. So he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it's like to go up against the 8th Air Force. So
How was that, though? I mean, from the standpoint of the experience on his side, and now you guys are meeting, you gentlemen are meeting at such a later point in your lives. Obviously, there was probably no animosity. Because your father was doing his duty, just like this gentleman was doing his duty. But how you can't help but to feel something. What is the feeling that you feel in that scenario?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I was so excited when I found out he was living, because all my dad knew in all the military records, the U.S. military records, they were just shot down by two German fighters. Right. And I thought that's all I'd ever know. Okay. And like you said, you know, he was pretty much like the U.S. airman, you know, young guy, 20 years old, you know, fighting for his country, trying to do a job, and trying to stay alive. And he said it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but that's war. And I get asked sometimes, well, don't you hate this guy that shot down your dad's plane? And maybe if my dad had been killed, I would feel differently. But I felt, and I still feel a personal relationship. Hans Berger is his name. Right. Because at one moment in time, Hans Berger's path crossed paths with my father, Howard Snyder. And as I mentioned earlier, World War II was the defining moment in my dad's life. And so Hans is part of my dad's story, part of his life. And so, I felt a connection to him.
Yeah, yeah. That's an amazing story. So thank you for sharing it.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you want to talk about before we break?
If anyone's interested in acquiring the book, most people get it on Amazon. It's the total title is Shot Down, the True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. If anyone wants an autographed copy, they can go to my website and acquire one. It's my website, Steve Snyder, Snyder, author.com. Steve Snyder, author.com. And there's a lot of information about World War II in general and the air war over Europe on my website, videos, interviews. So if people are interested in learning more about it, there's a lot of information on my website.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was truly a pleasure to meet you and to hear your father's story. It's inspirational, you know, and even just talking to you and feeling the energy coming from you from just having been able to learn, we don't all have stories like that in our backgrounds, and I'm glad yours ended successfully and in a happy manner, and you were able to take so much from it. But I truly appreciate the honor of you sharing it with me.
Well, thank you. The more you learn about these guys, the more humble you become.
Yeah, yeah.
But I appreciate being on your show, Ty. I've enjoyed a lot. You're a good guy.
Thank you so much, sir, and I truly appreciate it. You have yourself a great evening.
Thank you. You stay safe.
You as well. Thank you for listening to Think Different Nation with Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, a harrowing encounter of his father's adventures over Europe during World War II.